Yeah. Oh, that would be a good start, too. Yeah. You should do it.
Kristen.
Yeah, let's.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is the Wednesday afternoon session, 2 p.m., January 25th, 2017. If Carla, if you'd please call the roll.
Fritz.
Here.
Fish.
Here.
Saltzman.
Here.
Udaly.
Here.
Wheeler.
Here. If you could please call the first item.
Agenda item 85, place a measure on the May 16, 2017 ballot to amend city charter provisions to protect auditor's independence.
If I may, auditor, before you jump into your testimony, I think it would be helpful if we put the amendments on the table first, including yours, so that everybody understands what the amendments are, and that might help in your presentation to be able to speak to some of those amendments. Just in terms of framing the issue here, obviously the auditor plays an incredibly important function in city government. The auditor is independently elected. The auditor is responsible for ensuring that our city government operates in an accountable manner. The auditor and her team have worked hard to create a program that they would like to refer to the voters. It would be a charter amendment and therefore requires approval from the voters. The city council has to have a majority vote in order to refer this to the voters. So that's the spirit in which we're here today. We've had a work session. The auditor and her team have met with all of our offices individually to walk through some of the specifics related to this issue. Of course, some of us, I think just about all of us, have amendments that we would like to propose to this. And we may or may not have the opportunity to vote on this, just depending upon how much time we have. This could potentially get carried over to next week. If that's the case, we still have plenty of time to put it on. Well, not plenty, but we have time to put it on the ballot. So we'll take it from there. I'd like to start by asking each commissioner if they have amendments to read those amendments and briefly describe those amendments. To the degree that they feel sufficient, my intention is to second all of them for discussion purposes. We won't actually be voting on the amendments. We'll just be putting them on the table so that people have a chance to reflect and respond to them. After the auditor's presentation, there will be an opportunity for public testimony. I don't think I'm going to read the entire statement again. It's pretty common sense. If you are a lobbyist, please disclose that. If you are here representing an organization, please disclose that. And importantly, please keep your testimony to this particular issue. With that, I will ask my colleagues if they have any amendments they'd like to put on the table.
Mayor, I have an amendment.
Commissioner Fish.
So I offer the Fish Amendment, which I believe my colleagues have, and it reads as follows. Prior to the adoption, amendment, or repeal of any rule, the auditor shall provide reasonable public notice and opportunity for comment. The auditor may adopt interim rules without prior notice upon finding that failure to act promptly will result in prejudice to the public interest and shall be effective for a period of not more than 180 days. So I move that amendment.
Commissioner Fish, I'll second that for the purpose of discussion.
And Mayor, I have a brief statement in support.
Yes, sir.
If I could. Thank you, Mayor. Colleagues, I believe we do our best work in the light of day, and we can never take public trust for granted. During my 8 years on council, we've adopted many important reforms to increase transparency and accountability. We established a new oversight body for our public utilities, the Portland Utility Board. We made it easier for people to appeal administrative decisions made by the city. We created an independent budget office accountable to the council as a whole. We restored the city's chief financial officer position, bringing back the independent guidance we need to make good decisions about taxpayer money. And last year, we became the second city in the country to require political consultants to disclose their relationships with city council members. Today's proposed charter referral is yet another important reform designed to protect the independence of the elected auditor, the city's watchdog. I support the auditor's proposal for a number of reasons. First, I agree we should update the charter to reflect the increase in responsibilities over the past 30 years. Second, I strongly believe the auditor should have the right to seek independent legal advice. And third, I believe the auditor must have the freedom to issue tough audits without the fear of retaliation from the council or city bureaus. I've heard two basic arguments against referring this package to the May ballot. First, that these changes can be accomplished through changes to our code and not to our charter. While this has been the approach in some other cities, I believe that a charter change provides an extra measure of protection going forward. Second, some argue that this referral has been rushed and that we should hold off until next year. While we should never refer a charter change that is not well considered, the auditor has worked closely with the council to answer questions, clarify details, and to make reasonable changes. And today, I expect that my colleagues will have additional suggestions to strengthen the proposal. I have one of my own, and that's not unusual. I see no reason for further delay. The debate today should not be about whether strengthening the auditor's independence is a good idea. Of course it is. On that question, I believe there can be no debate. If this proposal is referred to the voters and passes, successful implementation will depend on a high level of cooperation between the auditor's office, the city council, the mayor, bureau leadership, and the public. And that's true of any charter change. Therefore, my amendment, which I have proposed, provides for public comment in the rulemaking phase, assuming that it is, in fact, approved by the voters. It was suggested by the League of Women Voters, thank you, Debbie Iona and others, and has the support of the auditor. And to our auditor, thank you for the spirit of collaboration and the open mind you have brought to these conversations. Today, I look forward to the presentation, the testimony, and our discussion.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Go next.
Commissioner Saltzman, you have a package, and if you want to go ahead and introduce them as a package.
It's just one amendment.
Just one amendment. Yeah. Thank you, sir.
And it's very simple. My amendment basically would remove placing the ombudsman role in the charter. And I offer that amendment for a couple reasons. I do appreciate the auditor bringing forward her amendments to enshrine the auditor's office independence into the city charter. And I fully support her rationale and reasoning behind her proposals. I have had concerns, however, about listing independent police review and the ombudsman in the charter. And without a chance to take more public input about that. And I think that that's really why I'm removing this, just as the auditor has herself removed the independent police review function from these charter changes. I feel that in order to gather more public comment and thought on that, I think we should do the same with respect to the ombudsman. And this is by no means a reflection on the performance of our ombudsman, past or present. I'm just reluctant to, there's very few positions that are spoken to in the city charter. You know, the city council, the auditor, the treasurer are all spoken to. These are all positions enumerated in our city charter. I'm just reluctant without more public comment and understanding about that to place yet another position in the charter, which when you place it in the charter, it's more or less there forever. And I think just as police review is a dynamic, changing environment, I think so is the role of investigating and holding cities accountable. I mean, the ombudsman movement got its start in the 1800s in Sweden and has really grown in popularity. But who's to say, you know, 2 decades from now, there may not be some other better way of holding government accountable than the ombudsman. But without having to, so that's why I would argue that we need some flexibility. At least those are my thoughts, but I would like to have the chance for the council to have a broader deliberation on this, and that's why I would offer my amendment to delete for the time being establishing the ombudsman in the city charter, just as we have deleted for the time being establishing the independent police review office in the charter.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'll second your amendment for the purposes of discussion. Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you, Auditor, for all of the work you've done on this. And I apologize to the public that I've got a lot of amendments, and unfortunately I was still working on them up until 1 o'clock today. And some that the auditor agrees with and others that we need to have a council discussion on. So I am concerned, as with Commissioner Saltzman, that this is, there has not been a lot of time for community members to know what's being proposed and therefore to comment on it. The first amendment that I'm calling it Fritz number one is actually an either or. The auditor's role in the city has changed significantly over the past 30 years. As such, it no longer makes sense to require the auditor, who is really a manager of a diverse set of programs, no different from the Secretary of State, to be a certified anything. The audit director needs to be a certified accountant or auditor. And unlike the mayors and the commissioners, we don't often get robust elections for the city auditor very often, and that needs to change, especially as a piece of oversight of a significantly more independent auditor under these proposed charter changes. Alternatively, if testimony we hear and the council's discussion says that we still want to keep the qualifications, then we should ensure that the outside oversight of the auditor's office occurs often and in a timely manner. So my second amendment is to, alternative on number one, is to require outside oversight every 4 years in the year prior to the auditor's election, so that there is some independent, not the council, looking at the performance with this significant new office. So,
I'll go ahead and accept them all as a package, and
thank
then
you.
When we get to the vote, we can vote individually.
Fabulous, thank you. So the next amendment, which we call number two, is to remove the new provision that the auditor may carry over any unused funds from year to year as provided by state law. None of the other elected officials have that option of not returning ending fund balance to the general fund. Thanks to the resolution that we passed 3 years ago now, the half of any of the ending fund balance is required to go to infrastructure maintenance. And that has something that the auditor and the audits have really said is a good thing, that we need to spend more money on basic infrastructure that may not be all that interesting, but it certainly needs to be done, like the roofs and such. Over the past 5 years, the auditor's office has returned over $2.2 million of unspent resources, which is certainly a credit to her fiscal responsibility. That money has been used to address our existing infrastructure maintenance need and the housing crisis. So, like the rest of the council, the auditor should have the ability to request carryovers and request position authority within the existing budget. I don't see that having a carryover of an average of $465,000 is the best choice for taxpayers' money. The next section is very much to speak to my brothers and sisters in the labor unions. We have a classification and compensation structure for a reason. The audits, the charter changes that happened under Mayor Potter in 2007 completely redid the civil service section and made it very clear what the rights of employees in classified positions is. And so I know that this is something that the auditor is intending to provide the same checks and balances and rights with her later administrative role. So this number three is... I messed that up, didn't I? Sorry. There's actually several different amendments in this... 2-506, which is again why I wish we'd had a bit more time so I could be more organized. So another one is that the new language says the auditor may appoint employees and establish their compensation. I think we should add within existing classifications and compensation structure so that we're not giving the auditor ability that none of us have to pay either less or more than the classification range for a particular type of work. What's that? That was three.
End of three, right?
Yeah, thank you. There's several in three. And then thank you for keeping track, Commissioner. No. The next amendments four and five are that the auditor is graciously accepted. In the section on deputies and employees, the proposal said the auditor should establish and administer human resources policies. We need to change that to the mandatory shall. And then further down that, we want to make it really clear that although the auditor gets to propose her budget with no input from outside offices, that the funding of the number of employees that that the auditor states is necessary is subject to funding by the council, that a future auditor could, of course, take any of that ending fund balance and move it into new positions. And that's just something that we all can do. But I think it's been very clear that the auditor respects our responsibilities as under state law, as the budget committee, that it has to be the council who makes that decision. In D, there's another, it's about procurement. We're changing another should to shall. And then this is the section that I was talking about earlier. It's 506A. And so we're proposing to strike the language that says the auditor's human resources policies and rules shall provide for for-cause disciplinary review procedures for an employee who is not an at-will or subject to a collective bargaining agreement. We want to be much more specific to make sure that future auditors know what's meant by that. So we would change it to the auditor's human resource policies and rules shall provide functionally equivalent protections as the classified service, including for-cause disciplinary review procedures for all auditors' office employees, with the exception of the chief deputy auditor, the ombudsman, and the audits director. And employees hired under that section of the charter, of the new section, and who are designated by the council as at will, and also employees subject to collective bargaining agreements are also protected under this amendment.
Very good. I'll second these for the purposes of discussion.
And I'll get them posted on the website as soon as I can so that people can follow them. I would like to actually request that if we could carry over the hearing till the next week, that would allow me and everybody else to really look over what we've done and make sure it's complete.
Very good. And Commissioner Udaly, before I jump in, did you have any amendments today?
I do not.
Very good. I've only got one myself. Add to the beginning of section 2-508F and 2-509F, adding the language subject to collective bargaining agreements. See if I can speak in English here. Subject to collective bargaining agreements with the city's recognized bargaining units. Add to section 2-509H, the powers and duties of the ombudsman shall not be exercised in contravention of any collective bargaining agreement or obligation of the city, and then continue on with the rest of the existing language.
Second those.
And Commissioner Saltzman seconds that. So we have these amendments now on the table. Thank you.
Excuse me, Mayor. I have an amendment as
I'm sorry. I apologize. Yes, Auditor.
For the record, I'm Mary Hall Caballero, City Auditor. And I have one amendment, and it is in Section 2-504. And it's about the salary, and it makes an effective date of January 1, 2019. And so that would have that section starting at the next full term of Auditor.
And is it not that way now? The salary of the auditor isn't that what is the same as the commissioner's, right?
It's the same as commissioner's in practice, but we're just making that reflective in the document. But just for clarity's sake, I didn't want people to think that this was about a raise for the auditor or something like that while I'm in this position. And so while that's true, it just is establishing the effective date as at the next term.
Mayor, consistent with the rules you established, I will offer the auditor's amendment, and it just requires a second.
That's correct. So Commissioner Fish moves. Is there a second? I'll second for the purpose of discussion.
Could I just say, in response to what you just said, likewise, I don't want people to think that we haven't been paying you properly up till now.
Very good. So now we have all the amendments on the table that people would like to put on the table. Auditor, I'll turn this over to your presentation. Thank you for your patience.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. I would just like to note that I have Margie Sollinger from my office here with me as well. When Portlanders elect a city auditor, they elect the person responsible for holding city government accountable. There is no asset more vital or fundamental to the ability to fulfill that responsibility than independence, particularly in a commission form of government where council members serve dual roles as the legislators of code and administrators of the executive branch. The independence of the auditor's office is something that cannot be left vulnerable to the politics of the day or the personalities of the moment. Independence was a priority during my campaign for this office and a topic I highlighted in this chamber when I was sworn in. I realized quickly after assuming office, just as my predecessors had warned, that the independent safeguards and charter that may have been adequate 35 years ago are insufficient today. Charter reflects an outdated version of the auditor's office, one that does not accurately portray or protect the comprehensive accountability and oversight operation that it has become. It is for these reasons that I have proposed modest but critical revisions to the city's charter, which can only be changed by a vote of the people. The proposed revisions provide the necessary safeguards to protect the auditor's independence and allow my office to continue its accountability work without perceived or actual interference. My office has been working on this proposal for the better part of a year. I have spoken to and collaborated with community groups, individuals, council members, and city staff. Those conversations were aided by news and editorial coverage that introduced the issue to a wide audience. The documents before you are better than where we started, because the people were willing to provide input in the spirit of placing the best option before voters. It's important to remember the proposal we discussed today represents the broad strokes of governance. If adopted by council and approved by voters, there will be an implementation phase where many, many details will be worked through. I look forward to joining council, Mayor Wheeler, and his executive team in a collaborative effort to ensure a smooth and cooperative transition to more independence for the auditor's office. My presentation today will illustrate the problem and provide an overview of my proposed solutions. I will also highlight areas of the proposal that have changed since the City Council work session on January 10th, including some additional improvements since we filed the resolution paperwork last week. Proposed replacement language for Exhibit A of your packet should be before you. We have marked up copies available for members of the public to see the evolution of the document as well. After my presentation, you will benefit from the views of three distinguished former city auditors. Following them, you will hear from a representative of a professional auditing association, as well as the director of the Office of Equity and Human Rights. You also have received written testimony from former Secretary of State Gene Atkins and various professional organizations that support the resolution, including the U.S. Ombudsman Association. For oversight entities such as the Auditor's Office to have credibility, they must be independent from those they audit and investigate. To be independent, auditors and investigators must be free in fact and appearance from personal, external, and organizational impairments. The important concept to note is that appearance counts as much as actual interference. Impairments exist when reasonable and informed observers suspect that our objectivity is compromised because we are beholden to or dependent on those we audit and investigate. When the public perceives that the objectivity of the auditor's office is compromised, our credibility as an independent entity is undermined, and the integrity of our audits and investigations may be questioned. Organizational independence can be achieved in a number of ways. One model is to place oversight functions in separate branches of government. For example, at the federal level, Congress has the Government Accountability Office to audit and investigate executive branch agencies overseen by the President. Another model is when an oversight function is at a different level of government, such as when a state office has investigative authority over local governments. Oversight agencies can also be led by an elected official. We have that model with the Oregon Secretary of State, where the Audits Division audits and investigates state agencies. What all of these models have in common is, at a minimum, administrative independence from the entities they audit and investigate. In Portland, having an elected auditor means we have the broad structure in place to have an independent home for oversight. However, the auditor's office is not appropriately independent from the city bureaus it audits and investigates. This is an organizational impairment, partly caused by the evolution of the office over the past 30 years. Prior to 1986, the responsibilities of the auditor's office were focused on administration and financial auditing. We still have those responsibilities and five more. In 1986, then City Auditor Jewel Lansing persuaded council and subsequently voters to authorize her to conduct performance audits. That pivoted the office toward its modern function as a comprehensive oversight entity. In 1991, the council and then Auditor Barbara Clark agreed to locate the Code Hearings Office in the auditor's office to provide it a non-political home and administrative support. 10 years later, former Auditor Gary Blackmer agreed to take responsibility for the Ombudsman and Independent Police Review, precursors of which had been in the mayor's office. In 2006, the lobbyist registration program was created and placed in the auditor's office. Charter and administrative practices have not kept pace with this evolution to ensure that the auditor's office has adequate safeguards to protect its independence. As a result, it does not have the arm's length distance it needs from those it audits and investigates. The good news is that the current charter provides a solid foundation on which we can build. Articles 3 and 5 in Chapter 2 of the Charter describe our government structure like this. Voters elect six officials with separate and distinct responsibilities. Commissioners in charge administer the executive branch. The auditor is responsible for independently holding the executive branch accountable to the public. Regrettably, this is not how the structure actually works. It has been eroded by administrative practices that were more appropriate 35 years ago, but no longer are acceptable given the oversight entity that the auditor's office has become. This is reality. The auditor is not treated as an elected official, but rather is treated like a bureau. This subordinated position puts the staff in three city offices and the commissioners in charge who supervise them between the elected auditor and the voters. The three offices that pose the greatest appearance of organizational impairments to the auditor's independence are the city attorney, budget, and management and finance. They exercise control over the auditor at the same time the auditor audits and investigates their operations. The top officials in these offices are appointed by the mayor and serve council. The auditor is not referenced in the sections of charter and code that govern them. We audit and investigate all three of these offices. The city attorney works for council and reports to the mayor, yet the auditor is expected to rely on the city attorney's advice for ongoing audits and investigations of the bureaus the council administers. The auditor does not have a separate legal advisor and is prevented by city code from seeking outside counsel without the permission of the city attorney. The chief administrative officer directs the Office of Management and Finance. This position reports to the mayor and works for council, yet exercises control over the auditor's decisions about human resources, procurement, and other internal matters. The city budget director reports to the mayor and serves council, yet the budget office uses the mayor's annual budget criteria to make recommendations that council relies on regarding the level of funding the auditor's office should receive and whether services and positions should be continued or cut. In past years, 80% of the budget office's recommendations about the auditor's budget were accepted by council, whether or not the auditor agreed with those recommendations. So at the very least, we've got an organizational structure that creates the appearance that the auditor's office is impaired by offices the auditor must hold accountable. This fact alone undermines the credibility of the auditor's office. The structural subordination of the auditor that currently exists creates the appearance that the auditor's office is dependent on or beholden to the executive branch. It is not unusual for auditor's office staff to be auditing and investigating bureaus at the very moment we are dependent on them to grant permission for us to take some action or are simultaneously investigating a complaint against an auditor's office employee. This is untenable in terms of our independence. In the last 2 years, we have audited or conducted investigations into complaints about the city attorney's office, the budget office, and several bureaus in the Office of Management and Finance, including Human Resources, Procurement, and Technology Services. This circular relationship is problematic for both the auditor's office and the bureaus because it introduces the appearance of conflicts of interest and fear of retribution when all parties may simply be doing their jobs. It unnecessarily calls into question decisions made in every transaction. This is especially true for our interactions with the Budget Office and the Office of Management and Finance. There is a similar but different issue with the City Attorney's Office. The City Attorney's client is the Municipal Corporation. As such, the City Attorney advises the City Council and bureaus, as well as the Auditor's Office. When it comes to the auditor's oversight functions, consultation with the city attorney's office creates the appearance of an impairment to the auditor's independence, and therefore our objectivity. In matters related to audits and investigations, the city attorney advises both the watchdog and the watched. This is untenable for the auditor's office. For example, the appearance of an impairment is most acute when the same attorneys try to advise the Auditor's Independent Police Review and the Police Bureau. This arrangement contributes to the perception that the civilian oversight of police is not sufficiently independent from the Police Bureau. That damages the credibility of my office. To avoid that consequence, my oversight staff and I forego legal advice on certain issues. This constrains our desire to have the best possible decision-making information and potentially increases the list of legal liability. It's hard to think up a worse outcome. The good news is that these organizational weaknesses can be fixed. There are models within our own government and from other jurisdictions that can guide us back to the structure that the public expects and that credible oversight requires. Our proposed solutions were informed by research into these and other jurisdictions and represent what we think are the best elements that would work in our commission form of government. Professional organizations for local government auditors, ombudsmen, and civilian overseers of law enforcement support the proposed charter safeguards that will serve to protect the independence of these functions. These three organizations submitted letters of support for the resolution you are considering today. The charter amendments I have proposed would accomplish two objectives. They would update the charter so it reflects the modern office and matches function to form, and they would end the auditor's dependence on the bureaus we audit and investigate. The amendments address four areas. One amendment would place the ombudsman in charter. You may recall from the prior work session that I originally recommended placing independent police review in the charter as well. but subsequent input from some community groups indicated that it would be premature given the strong desire for ongoing conversations about the structure of police oversight. Today's proposal does not include language specific to independent police review, but it will benefit from the remaining safeguards nonetheless. The Ombudsman has been in the Auditor's Office for 16 years. It is responsible for conducting impartial and in-depth investigations in response to complaints from members of the public who feel wronged by the city. It is a last resort for those who have been unable to resolve their disputes directly with the bureaus or through counsel. The language in the charter proposal mirrors that already exists in code. No new powers are included in the proposal for the Ombudsman. By design, the Ombudsman tries to resolve issues informally and at the lowest level possible. So some in our community may not be as familiar with its work. But for those whose livelihood has been rescued, whose business has stayed open, or whose pocketbook has been protected from unfair charges because of the Ombudsman's office, it is a memorable and vital service. And it does occasionally take on some higher profile issues. Here are some examples. The Ombudsman was responsible for bringing in the FBI after a complaint investigation into transportation employee Ellis McCoy revealed evidence of criminality. Just this past month, the Ombudsman's office issued a report detailing its discovery that the city had been unknowingly losing callback information about tens of thousands of 911 calls for more than a decade. The Ombudsman persuaded council to pass legislation requiring that members of the public be notified of their appeal rights. The legislation also stopped the practice of charging more than $1,300 to appear before the city's hearings officer. Because of an Ombudsman investigation and subsequent advocacy, Portland has the power to punish businesses that defraud the city's program for social equity and contracting. While it's hard to argue the public benefits of these examples, the Ombudsman's office can be a target for political retribution when powerful people do not like the outcome of an investigation. When the Ombudsman exists only in code, its very existence is fragile. The opportunity for retaliation is reason enough to place the Ombudsman in charter, but threats to its funding made by two prior mayors make it more than a theoretical concern. Most recently, when the Ombudsman concluded there were undisclosed conflicts of interest among powerful members of an advisory board during the West Quadrant planning process, a former mayor threatened to replace the Ombudsman's office with a website. For as long as the Ombudsman's office exists, it should be protected from retaliation and perceived as independent from those it is tasked with investigating. If at some point Portlanders no longer need an Ombudsman, removal of the function should require a vote of the people. The argument for placing the Ombudsman in charter is the same one Jewel Lansing made back in 1986 when she sought to place in charter the authority for the auditor to conduct performance audits. In pointed but clear language, Auditor Lansing said, "Right now I'm doing auditing only at the generosity of counsel. That means if for some political reason they didn't like an audit that came out, they could just stop it tomorrow. People can't believe that there's no authority in the charter for the auditor to audit, but that's true." A charter amendment protecting the auditor's ability to audit was the sound choice 30 years ago, and it is the sound choice now to protect the Ombudsman's investigations. The second solution is to end the auditor's dependency on bureaus that creates the appearance of organizational impairments. The proposed amendment would place responsibility for internal control with the auditor and require external reviews by independent entities instead of management and finance bureaus. Former Secretary of State Gene Atkins captured the importance of ending the dependency on those we audit and investigate in a letter supporting our proposal. She said, "The power to control and manage our own internal functions is fundamental to faithfully executing our constitutional duties." The Oregon Secretary of State's office is the primary model we look to for how to achieve independence with regard to human resources and procurement. The language is also similar to an example closer to home, the Portland Development Commission. The commission is a city agency that has independent safeguards for the purpose of insulating spending on urban renewal projects from political pressure. While today's proposal provides for administrative independence, it lands short of that enjoyed by the Development Commission, which has a fully separate infrastructure system from those of the city. We, however, intend to continue in the overhead model for funding, which will allow us to consult with subject matter experts in the bureaus and use existing technology while retaining decision-making responsibility. Let me walk you through the key points in the language regarding employment and procurement, as well as some additional improvements made since the work session. Bear with me through this very text-heavy slide while I cover the main points. The noteworthy replacement language is in the blue box. You can also find it on page 2 of Replacement Exhibit A. The proposal continues to make the auditor responsible for the conduct of the office's 50 full-time equivalent employees, but authorizes the establishment of personnel policies and a disciplinary system for employees in positions not covered by a collective bargaining agreement. Collective bargaining procedures would still apply to the 5 employee positions represented by a union. In the very rare circumstances where we need to discipline or discharge employees, those who currently are covered by civil service protections will continue to have them and will have access to a review process by an independent body. This follows the procedures used by the Secretary of State's office, which is not subject to the rules of the Department of Administrative Services, but must comply with state and federal law. Since filing the resolution, we have made some additional revisions to this section that you'll note in the replacement document for Exhibit A. We added a provision that indicates the auditor's office is committed to adopting policies that are consistent with citywide standards for employees, except where those policies conflict with the auditor's independence or ability to fulfill the auditor's duties. Also, while the intent of the original language was to mirror protections employees already have, it was interpreted by some by making all employees in the auditor's office at will. We added language in the replacement exhibit, and Commissioner Fritz has mentioned an additional amendment today to clarify the original intent that employees currently covered by civil service protections will retain similar protections, including dismissal for cause. While the auditor's office enters into only a handful of contracts per year and the median dollar amount is low, the principle of administrative independence from those we audit and investigate applies here too. We have proposed a reasonable middle ground that grants contracting authority to the auditor and requires the adoption of administrative rules, but retains counsel as the local contract review board. In terms of implementation, potential vendors would not detect any change in the process, as the auditor's office intends to continue using the online procurement center for its handful of contracts per year. It is important that the auditor's office assures the public that it is operating efficiently and effectively. To accomplish that, the proposal includes requirements for internal controls and external review that go beyond what currently are in place. Among our existing controls are voters, council's budget authority, standards associated with a required professional credential, peer reviews for audit quality, and internal controls. The proposal would result in the expansion of existing controls and add 2 new ones to assure the public and counsel that the auditor's office is efficient and legally compliant through organizational assessments and compliance reviews. As with our current peer reviews for audit quality, we would make results of the new assessments public and available to counsel. In contrast to the individual transaction controls we have now, The additional assessments have the advantage of looking across and more deeply within the office's operations, identifying risks, and suggesting areas for improvement. None of this occurs today. The third solution authorizes the auditor to access independent legal advice. This is something that Charter already authorizes for two city bureaus, the Portland Development Commission and the Fire and Police Disability and Retirement. This authority will improve decision-making within the auditor's office by enabling access to independent advice. It will eliminate the problem of sharing counsel with those we are auditing and investigating, and it will enable us to receive legal advice based on our mission of ensuring open and accountable government. The fourth solution relates to the process for the auditor's budget, which is less than 1% of the overall city budget, 0.53% to be exact. It is relatively stable year over year. In other jurisdictions, auditors can bypass the executive branch and directly submit their budget request to a legislative branch. That is not an option in Portland. Addressing the appearance of an organizational impairment during the budget setting process is more challenging here because of council's dual roles as legislators and executive administrators. A consequence of council's fiduciary role over the auditor's budget is that it creates a perception that decisions could be based on a desire to limit accountability. This was especially troublesome last year when the city experienced record revenue and the auditor was the only elective office to take cuts. It is also important to acknowledge that any dollar provided to the auditor is one individual commissioners give up for their own bureaus. This is an inherent conflict caused by the commission form of government and requires that steps be taken to mitigate it. The charter amendment I propose is an incomplete solution, but it represents a necessary first step in the right direction. The proposal is focused on the process and is intended to enable a direct dialogue among the six elected officials. It respects council's fiduciary obligation to set the city's budget, but also acknowledges the separate and distinct responsibilities of the auditor. The proposal requires the auditor to prepare a budget request in accordance with state law and submit it for council consideration during the regular budget process. The auditor's requested budget would not be subject to the City Budget Office's review. In response to a suggestion that came from the work session, the language was updated to clarify that council is not prohibited from seeking advice about the auditor's budget requests. Council would decide the merits of the auditor's budget request and modify accordingly. In evaluating the auditor's request, the proposed language suggests that council evaluates the auditor's budget based on the auditor's priorities and duties, rather than evaluating it as a bureau budget that must conform to the council's priorities for the executive branch. The proposal also includes the authority to carry over unused funds in compliance with state law. Although it varies from year to year, historical data indicate the carryover amounts would range from $100,000 to $200,000. Throughout the year, the budget office monitors how the auditor's office is using its appropriated funds and determines whether it must return money to the general fund. The ability to carry over funds is an extension of the principle that the city budget office, an entity we audit and investigate, should not be involved in the auditor's budget. Under the proposal, so long as the council appropriated funds are spent as intended for either personnel or materials and services, the auditor would retain unused dollars for those purposes the following year or place them in contingency. If funds in contingency are needed for purposes other than those originally agreed to, the auditor would be required by state law to return to council to request a change. And of course, council's budget setting authority operates as a check on how the auditor exercises the ability to carry over unused funds. That the auditor's office be independent from those it audits and investigates is fundamental to the credibility of our work. Taxpayers invest about $9 million in the accountability and transparency functions in my office. That investment should not be undermined by an inappropriate organizational structure, especially when it can so easily be fixed. This is an opportunity for the six elected officials to demonstrate to the public that the city is honest about its strengths and weaknesses and working hard to continuously improve. The amendments I prepared for your consideration address the greatest risk to independence, avoid duplication where possible, retain access to in-house expertise, and increase accountability across the board. This is a governance issue, and governance issues belong in charter. While the city code belongs to you, the charter is the people's document. This matter should be decided by voters in the May 2017 election. The time is ripe for asking voters to weigh in and have the ultimate say. We have generated considerable momentum, and the city has a history of referring important charter amendments to the May election, where voters tend to be well-informed because measures are less likely to be crowded out by more high-profile issues. More important, the cost of delay or inaction is too steep to ignore. The credibility of the auditor's office is at stake. Portlanders deserve an auditor's office that is beholden only to the cause of good governance. Mayor, I have two panels of invited guests to bring up, but I will defer to council if you want to continue discussing the amendments or...
No, please continue.
I just have a question, or two questions, actually. Is that all right?
Please.
Thank you. The proposed amendment says that there will be periodically external review. How often are you envisioning that there would be external review of the auditor's office?
I think that that would be based on need and based on priorities, given how much money I would have in any given year for those types of reviews.
That's not very reassuring. Anyway, the second question I have is there's appeal for in the classified service now in the charter, there's the right of appeal to the Civil Service Board. And I understand that since the Civil Service Board is appointed by the mayor, that's not acceptable to you. Who are you thinking would be the outside appeal body when you set up the structure to be similar in the auditor's chapter?
We have talked about this on a limited basis with the Secretary of State's office, and the model they use is to have an administrative law judge. We also could have a panel similar to the Civil Service Board look at that. And I think there's some considerations, some legal considerations around that that I'd like to pursue should this pass before we make a decision one way or the other. Those are the kinds of details that I was referencing that would have to be further researched and decided.
So then, though, once this leaves our desks and goes to the voters, we don't have any we're not involved in the administrative rules and the other implementation. The proposed change says specifically the auditor shall judge whether or not it's the right thing or not. So for the first set of administrative rules, because I'm very concerned about that ability for classified people who currently have the protections of the classified service having similar protections in the office as you envision it. But you're not thinking of bringing back any of those details to council, right?
No, that would not be my thought today, but we would, based on the amendment that Commissioner Fish brought forward, we would be posting administrative rules to the public for public comment. And we also have some language in there that we will be consistent with city rules and regulations across the board so that the city as a whole is consistent. And I think that that's where some of your concerns would be assuaged.
And under our current system, when the Human Resources Director is redoing any administrative rules, all of the council get notified of that. I expect you do as well, and have the opportunity to comment. how would a citizen or a council member know that you were in the process of doing administrative rules?
Well, we have some administrative rulemaking capacity in our office now. For example, the hearings office has to provide 30 days notice, and the last time that the hearings officer changed the administrative rules for that office, we used the mailing lists of the Office of Neighborhood Involvement. In my office, we have a lot of mailing lists that go out to people, the council clerks, the ombudsman, and Independent Police Review and Audit Services. They have large mailing lists who they regularly communicate with. And so we would use all of those methods, certainly, as we do now. But there could be, if you have other suggestions, I'd be happy to consider that.
Certainly for this first set, like your commitment that you would let the council offices know that they're ready.
Oh, certainly. Certainly.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So if I may, Auditor, I just want to state the obvious. We have another time certain event that's supposed to happen in a half an hour. I understand we have 27 people signed up so far for public testimony on this item. This is also a very important item, so I'd like to continue this. But I want to give the bad news to those of you that are here for the 3:30 time certain. I'm pretty much certain it isn't going to happen at 3:30. It will probably be closer to 4:30, and I apologize for that. But that's where we are right now.
Thank you, Mayor. So, Madam Auditor, I have a question. We have put on the table a number of amendments, and I want to be sure as we continue the hearing that I'm clear as to which ones you support, which ones you don't support, and then I would hope that at the end of the hearing, after you've heard all the testimony, you could be invited back just to have a discussion with the council to see whether there are any other changes that you might consider. So my amendment, based on a suggestion from the League of Women Voters, my understanding is you support that.
I do.
Okay, thank you. The mayor has proposed two changes relating to collective bargaining agreements. Do you support those?
I do.
Okay. Commissioner Saltzman has proposed taking the ombudsman out altogether. Your position on that?
I do not support that.
Okay. And Commissioner Fritz and you have reached agreement on a number of amendments, which is laudable. She has one amendment with an alternative and two other amendments. Do you support them or not at this point?
I have differing opinions on them. Would you like me to go down the list?
I'll tell you what. Because we have people backed up, could we invite the auditor back at the end, Mayor?
Let's do that. Let's get to some of the tests. You said you had two invited panels.
Yes.
Could be.
Can I just say, and they will be brief.
If there is an amendment, Madam Auditor, that you don't support now, that based on the testimony and further consideration, you have a alternate suggestion, I hope at the end of today you can come back and share that with us. Okay. If there's a path to getting to some compromise.
So before you leave, I just want to make sure I understand under your proposal how your budget gets set. Is it the City Council the final decider on your budget?
Yes, that's your responsibility under state law.
Okay, so if you're given a 5% cut, just to choose a number, you understand that has to be you have to come up with a budget that's 5% less than what it was the year before.
Correct.
Okay.
And it says that you have the obligation to modify or not modify that budget. That's your decision. I would put up a request, and then you all would decide it.
So we are free to say you can't cut this, but you can cut that. Is that what I understand by saying that?
Well, I think that the way I would view that is that it would be my responsibility to make my best pitch for how I wanted to spend the money, and then it would be your decision about whether I had made my case or not. We have some leeway already existing today about applying resources differently so long as personnel services remain personnel services and materials and services remain materials and services.
So I guess what I'm speaking to, you know, there's a dynamic here. It's probably true in every government that when bureaus are asked to make cuts, they often offer up the things they think are the least acceptable to the governing body to cut. And so what I'm trying to ensure here is if you were to engage in that same practice, that we would be able to say, no, you can't cut that very popular program or that very important program, you have to cut over here, as long as it falls within the guidelines of personnel and materials and services.
I believe that's correct. I don't think that it would be, for example, there was a retirement and audit services, and I moved that position to create a deputy ombudsman. And so I think I have that authority now. I don't think I have the authority to say I will get rid of all the council clerks.
Right.
So, okay. I think that is that what you're describing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
That's what I'm describing.
Yeah. Okay. I will not get rid of all the council clerks.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Okay. I will quickly introduce the two panels. I have asked them to be very brief, and...